Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Friday edition of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer, and I'm joined today by Gabriel Krauser. Gabriel, how are you?
Good, thank you. How are you all?
I'm very well, thanks. And CEO of the IRR, Franz Cronier. Franz, how are you?
I'm very well, Nick. Good day to you. Good day to Gabriel.
How's this? So we did talk a little bit on Wednesday about the budget. We got thoughts from Herman Pretorius and Terence Corrigan. But I think it's also worth continuing some of that discussion, considering how important I think it is and what it kind of portends for the future. So, Franz, I know, of course, you have thoughts on the budget. What do you think that this budget means? What's the most important thing we should think about it?
You know, it also helps to think for a couple of days after the thing happens and to see what the other analysts say, what markets do, and a few things are crystallizing. The first is that Treasury growth forecasts over the past decade have been wrong by around 50%. And if you apply that margin to this forecast, South Africa is easily looking at a growth contraction south of negative 10% this year. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that once you strip out all the technical language, in practice, the government is now looking to borrow between 30 and 40 of every 100 rand it intends to spend. And that, you know, you don't have to be much schooled in economics to have a bad feeling about that. And where it's leading. The third thing that struck us, as we thought, is, you know, the minister presented two debt curve scenarios. He called one passive, I think, and one active. And he said the passive curve would be what happens to debt, to GDP, government debt, if we don't intervene. And he sees it going up very sharply. And the active curve is what he said would happen if we intervene appropriately. And then they're able to stabilize debt and even achieve a primary surplus in 2023-2024. We think the passive forecast might even be too optimistic. The minister said he'd only introduced it for illustrative purposes, not because that was a quote, not because he thought it would occur. But some of the assumptions under the passive curve even include the idea that growth will recover but remain very low. Now, that's very much in doubt. The upshot of all the points I've made is that we think the market reaction on the whole to the budget and the reaction of a few of the analysts who've been published is too quick to give credibility to the minister's assurances that something around and about the active debt scenario will materialize. And that's a great risk now, because the data a year from now or so is going to show that it was wrong, the active outlook. Might even show that we're in a worse position than the passive outlook. And that means that South Africa might be in for some real sort of regression in both sort of its currency and its economic outlook when that shock hits. In terms of the response from the government, I found clients kind of pushed us to tell them what the government would do. And we found it really hard to do that. Like, on the one hand, clients thought, would this prompt reform? And we said, no, definitely not. And the reason is there are no reformers around, real reformers. Even people that we call reformers are not actually reformers in the sense that they're willing to concede that you need a complete reworking of labor and empowerment policy and the securing of property rights. So you can't have reform if you don't have reformers. Reform's off the charts. Then better informed clients say to us, well, you know, what's the risk of some real sort of radical action, seizing financial assets and pensions? And we say to them, the risk is very real, and you should be hedged for that, because the current EWC provisions, where they're headed, would allow that. That allow the seizure of pensions. So hedge for that. But we also weren't convinced that that's what was going to happen. And so we found ourselves in a tough position. We sort of asked to say what will happen. And where I'm settling ever more is that nothing will happen. The government will simply allow itself to be overwhelmed by events. And South Africa will teeter on the brink of a debt crisis. And it might teeter for a very long time because there's so much cash that's going to be made available to the world by all the stimulus of Western governments. And some of that will find its way to South Africa because the yields might justify it. And that will keep us teetering. The government will do nothing constructive to stop teetering. And my sense, gee, you hope you're not wrong, is that they'll probably stop short of, they may stop short. I realize I'm going to be judged on this statement one day. They could stop short of seizing pensions and assets. So they just get overwhelmed. And then we teeter for quite a long time. And then we ask ourselves the question, what then? What happens? And the answer became only one thing, that a future unknown as yet, global or domestic, political or other shock, will tip us into that debt crisis, which will ultimately conclude later in this decade, maybe towards the second half of the decade, in a South Africa being forced to consider a full-on structural adjustment program and the ceding, therefore, of policy sovereignty to an external financier. And that's the take, Nick, on that's a kind of our considered view now a few days later of what the minister said in his supplementary budget.
So I know we've talked a little bit about the ways in which South Africa is quite stable in being dysfunctional. I know Gabriel is a very big fan of that idea. I know Gabriel has mentioned on this show before the idea that we could be Argentina for 100 years or something like that. But isn't there an alternative scenario where essentially there comes a point where sort of business and all these people who are currently taking the minister's reassurances seriously about how we're going to stabilize the debt and that kind of thing, when they have a moment of panic and will suddenly rush away, which will accelerate things falling apart? I mean, is that a realistic thing to suggest? Sorry, you're muted, Franz.
Sorry, I was muted. No, I think we're past that point already, Nick. I think they've already panicked and rushed away. You only need to attend a wealth seminar of one of South Africa's bigger financial institutions to see that. Not quite the same line they give when interviewed by a journalist. Away, all your money. They put it very rebalancing your portfolio to reflect externalized assets. So no, I think that's already passed. And but what you say is, I say that there's too much credibility conceded to the minister. But I don't know if that's true, totally true, because I think even the people who pretend to take it credibly have already externalized themselves to a point at which they're well hedged in case their publicly recorded expressions of confidence in the government prove to be wrong. So I think we're past that point. And I actually, when I say teeter on the brink of a crisis, I think I'm kind of saying, I don't know, 100 years, maybe Argentina, but I think Gabriel's right. But what will help us, what will make Gabriel right, is all this cash that's been injected into the world. The cash has to go somewhere. And why not take a punt on South Africa? You know, it's a fraction of your portfolio. What can't really go wrong? South Africa's so small. The money available is so big. Yeah, and that will hold South Africa up. It will hold it. It will hold it from collapsing into the abyss. But external shock and the abyss beckons. Question is now for me, it's a question of time. How long? But it could be very long before that abyss is experienced.
So, Gabriel, two questions to you. One is France right that we're really going to be able to grab a chunk of that international money? And two, how long until the abyss?
Okay, can we grab international money? The answer is yes. I think that the monetary easing that you're seeing in the US, in Europe, and other established economies is extremely – I mean, it's almost crazy how much free money is being printed, and it does have to find a home. We are an attractive investment in Africa insofar as we have a large and relatively stable financial market. I mean, it's significantly weakened, but we think that a lot of the, you know, downgrades to junk earlier this year, that was already priced in. We still, you know, have a large financial services sector, the most established one on the continent. So that's a good place to kind of park your cash, especially if you want to enlarge your footprint. In an investment destination, that's nice to brag about, right? So you might look for your returns in the American Stock Exchange and look for your bragging rights by sending a paltry amount of money South Africa's way as a foreign investor. Likewise, the IMF has sort of opened the purse, and it's not clear yet what kind of conditions – it's not clear to me yet what kind of conditions are attached to those loans, but they definitely are looking to sustain global markets by injecting liquidity. And South Africa's, you know – we're already in talks. The how long to the abyss question has to be answered through the lens of where is the money going to go. I think one of the troubles with South Africa is that, it's important to focus on party politics and on cabinet, but the sort of bulk of the drain on wealth in this country really comes from the civil service, from SOEs, from what we often praise here as the patronage network. And that is, you know, the carded deployments have been made, but it's not officially, a party issue. And I think the concern there is that, between the civil service and those state-owned enterprises and those private companies that have entered into public-private partnerships, they would probably be first in the queue to get the money. And insofar as they don't add more value than they absorb, that maintains the kind of slow descent, the sort of SAA story of crashing into the floor and then not quite burning. Instead, you sort of crash further and further and you find new basement levels to crash into. And then you rise like a phoenix on a new gust of injected liquidity and then you crash again. So I think that, you know, that's the zombie problem of the South African economy, is that when we do get cash, it tends to be injected into corpses rather than into the sort of vibrant parts of the sector that are still around.
All right. So, Franz, do you have any final thoughts on this topic before we move on to discussing infections around the world of COVID?
Let's go to infections. I want to say something on infections. I don't even know what Gabriel's going to think, so let's see what he thinks. Yesterday, roundabout, the number of COVID new daily cases in America was the highest it had ever been, and it's more than twice as high as the figures that were recorded on around the 1st or so of June, when the cases reached a low point relative to the peak that had been recorded in America on around the 24th of April. So there was a sharp increase from the beginning of the year to the 24th of April in America. Then cases came way down, almost by about 50%, and now they've taken off again, and they're now the highest they've ever been. But there's not a second wave of infections in America. That is not what's happening. It's a nonsense, it's a myth, and it's going to cause a lot of harm. It's going to rattle markets a bit next week. because people don't understand what's going on. What is actually happening in America, here's the thesis to be challenged, is that as the economy began to reopen, testing protocols changed. And more people began to be tested. They went back to work, so they had to get tested, or the hypochondriacs, and they had a cold, and they were tested. And lo and behold, they figured out that they also have COVID. But symptoms are not worse than the symptoms that's not worse than having a cold. The proof that I'm right is that the number of deaths daily recorded in America has not increased in line with the number of infections, and the age profile of the people who are infected has become a lot lower, the average age of infected people, than was the case at the peak in April. And this is a very dangerous situation because the media is blowing this up as second wave. Some American policymakers have even stalled their reopening efforts to counter this so-called second wave. But I don't think there is a second wave. I think the peak has already passed for much of the world and America and Asia and Europe. And there's something for yourself and for Gabriel to, do you think I'm right? Am I wrong?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think that there's something to the claim that the thought that there is a second wave here is being exaggerated. I think that's right. But I don't know that there's no second wave at all. I think that the sort of flat line in death rate is a strong indicator. You know, one of the things you have to do when thinking about COVID is sort of pair off the people that are extremely vulnerable, that if they get this disease are likely to get very ill, and if they get very ill are likely to die, from the rest. There are a lot of people, most people, the vast majority of people, if they get the disease, won't even notice it, or if they do notice it, are going to have very minimal symptoms and be just fine. So I think that the question is essentially, the question that should worry one is to what extent are the elderly being exposed to the virus. And in this regard, America did an extremely bad job. So did the United Kingdom, for example, of trying to protect its healthcare system by offloading elderly patients that didn't have COVID or that weren't tested and might have had COVID, many times turned out that they did have COVID, sending them straight into old age homes so that they'd have more ICU beds available in the hospitals so that they could then, deal with the massive influx that they were expecting. Now, there was no massive influx. None of the field hospitals were used. Most hospitals were totally fine. There's no case that I can find in the U.S. of someone needing an ICU bed and not getting it. But there are huge numbers of cases of people being taken into old age homes and then the virus spreading like wildfire there and then lots of people dying. So I think that the death rate that you saw in America earlier, particularly in May and June, some of that was sort of artificially high because of poor U.S. choices, and New York State is the worst example of them all. And there's a sort of battle that'll continue through the election cycle between Cuomo, the governor, and Trump, the president, as to who's responsible for that. But I think that if you were to take that artificial disaster out, the death rate would have been lower then. So for it to be flat now indicates that in some sense it has gone up. In terms of what you might call sort of non-artificial viral spread, the virus just doing what it does. That's the first thing to bear in mind. The second thing to bear in mind is that the U.S. has had a series of events that have been represented sort of COVID hotspots where super spreaders might have done a terrible job of sending the disease around. Some of these have been protests against the lockdowns. Most of these have been protests of Black Lives Matter. And some of it is sort of people seeing that going on and thinking, hell's teeth, I might as well go on holiday and have a wonderful 4th of July. And those events do sort of line up with the data. The places, the sunnier parts of America, the places where people have been protesting more, those do seem to be places that are having a bit of a spike. But the reason that I say that the media is exaggerating it is because if 20 to 60-year-olds are increasing the proportion at which they have this disease. This is not a major health concern because the asymptomatic rate is so high and because the morbidity and fatality rates are so low. So, I mean, in a way, what you would really want is, you know, for all old people to be protected and then everyone else to get the disease. Insofar as, you know, we don't believe that a vaccine or off-label use of an existing treatment is going to do the work anytime soon, that would be the best way to establish saturation, as Levitt calls it, at which point it's hard for the disease to transmute. So I don't look at the American data and think, gosh, they're in trouble. I think they're fine. But I do think that the shifts in their social norms about what kinds of behavior you can, the anti-social distancing protests effectively, I think, have changed the masking and social distancing behavior of Americans.
So I want you guys to tell me if you think these are reasonable criticisms. Of this idea that the death rate has stayed flat, is this not just because we're not entirely sure how much the lag is between these things? So when cases go up, it usually takes a while for that to be reflected in deaths. We've seen this kind of over and over again where a country's cases shoot way up and they stay up for a while, and then no one thinks that, you know, everyone says, oh, it looks like we've avoided a massive wave of deaths, and then deaths start because the disease can take a while to kill people. So that's the first note of caution I might call for. And the other one is that maybe it's just because we are seeing the infection amongst younger people. So there is a genuine spike. But as Gabriel says, because it's amongst younger people, that it's not going to kill as many people. I mean, do you think those are fair comments?
Yeah, I think I just want to say, as far as the data, as far as I'm aware, the sort of time between infection and death, the median time is something like 3 weeks.
Yeah, that sounds about right. So I think we'll have to see, but hopefully there is no second wave, because a second wave would be, I think, utterly catastrophic. But of course,
even if there is one, I don't think there is one. And I think if you want to increase your infection curve, you should test more people, and then it will go up. And if you test less people, will go down and no one will really notice. And the thing to measure is deaths. And if I'm wrong, the reason you'll see that in the American death figures lifting appreciably over the next 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Should that occur, here's another very interesting angle on it. We looked at flu-related deaths in America over the past decade. And the worst flu season on record was 2017-18. With an estimated 61,000 deaths, and the best was, I think, about just a few years before that, 12,000.
I think it was, yeah.
Yeah, and America's now sitting at 122,000 COVID deaths, which is halfway to the top end initial Fauci forecast of 240,000. If they, you know, stop at around 150,000, what that will mean in terms of lethality is that COVID to America was 2.5 times more lethal than the worst American flu season on record, but 13 times more lethal than the best flu season on record. And I don't think there's a better way to, between those two extremes, you can reach your own conclusion about how dangerous this virus is. But I don't think there's a better way to answer the question of how dangerous is COVID to the world. And, the great thing about America is that
France, yeah. We lost you on the great thing about America.
Yeah. Thing about America is the data. It's so good that you can go and find benchmarks for things. Takes you not very long. You find these amazing databases maintained by these CDC is not obscure, but often obscure agencies. There's one, I segue to something else that I was introduced to yesterday. I think it's the Washington Post's database of police shootings in America. And it's a brilliant resource. You can actually go into it. You can pick a year. You can pick age groups, you can pick race categories, you can pick whether the person shot was armed or running away or whatever, and you can produce numbers on how many people are shot by American cops and under what circumstances.
Yeah.
And I'm still delving into it a bit. I think in time I'd say a bit about some of those numbers. But if you want to have a really interesting 5 minutes, go to the Washington Post police shooting database and go and play with some of the numbers, and your eyes will open to a world completely at odds with that presented by social media and the mainstream media around the question of police shootings in America. The facts, as always, mustn't be allowed to get in the way of a good story.
Yeah, I mean, I've been looking at that Washington Post database for a couple of weeks now, and the, you know, headline correlation is basically an inverse relationship between the extent, length, and intensity of Black Lives Matter protests and the extent and intensity of sort of police brutality directed against Black people. So as the police do better and better by the standards of Black Lives Matter, they protest more and more, which is sort of the opposite to the kind of relationship that you might expect.
No, but you could say too, Gabriel, you could say too, I don't think America has a particular problem, a pronounced one, but you could say too that, you know, that movement has had the effect of making overzealous American cops think twice. It's probably also had the effect in more so though. I mean, I put that out there. I think that happened to an extent, but I think what it has done is caused a phenomenon called under-policing in poor communities.
Yeah.
Which is what happens when cops under pressure, social pressure, political pressure, just actually skirt situations that go down badly on Twitter.
And so one of the weird viruses is the blue flu, hey? A lot of people in Chicago have been calling for the blue flu, which is where you say, hey, police, rather than come in and deal with the problems, could you just phone in sick and say you've got the flu so that we can get on with our business? That call for the blue flu in Chicago has been accompanied by some of the worst rates of shootings in that town, 11 people killed over Father's Day weekend last weekend, one of them a small child.
I think Atlanta also is suffering from a similar phenomenon.
Yeah, and I think there's another phenomenon that's already started playing itself out in America, and that's that the caliber of policemen is going to deteriorate. Because if you're a person with options, career options, you might not choose the police anymore because it's a quagmire. You might go and do something else. And so the caliber of police officers will fall, and vulnerable communities will increasingly be exposed to the consequences of under-policing. And, you know, we'll only know in a few years' time, but if on the back of the success of these protests, they've been successful in what they've sought to achieve. If on the back of the success of the protests, you later see that the vulnerability of vulnerable communities, already vulnerable communities, to violence and crime increases sort of on the 5 to 10 year view, yeah. I don't think that will be a surprise.
Yeah. So just to finish up here, because of course we have drifted a bit here from the COVID stuff. We, of course, in South Africa are in a very different place to where Europe and America is. Do you think that we're kind of around the middle? When do you think our peak is going to be, and when are we going to be in the same place the Americans and the Europeans are in? Sorry, France, we lost you there. On you said what you thought, and then we didn't hear you.
I was going to say, and then I saw I'd been lost, so then I stopped. We were looking at a lot of infection numbers, and now I'm stopped looking at them because they're so high wire and all over the place that they're not really telling us anything. So I asked the analysts, do for me death numbers instead. But those are better. So we've been watching those. There's no indication in the national death curve that a peak has been reached at all. This makes us a little bit different to many other parts of the world that tended to hit their peaks within 60 days of recording their 100th case. And we haven't done that. But I've looked at so many of the curves for so many countries. We've done death curves for so many countries that I think that the way the curve is now progressing and the infection numbers are lifting, that parts of the country are probably going to be pretty near peak this month still, which is only a couple of days. And I would be surprised if the great bulk of the country has not hit its peak into the end of July, very early August, with then some laggards coming thereafter. That's my, you know, we spend a lot of time looking at the curves. And when I look at the South African curve and look at so many other countries, that's my sense of where we are at the moment.
Yeah, I think that's about right. I think that the one open question is the extent to which peaks are reached because of natural immunity factors. People who effectively had some other strain of a coronavirus in recent times and therefore have the antibodies prepared to knock this one out, and maybe even genetic or other factors. And I think that one of the things that's hard to control for when looking across countries is the extent to which in all countries where people can, they seem to have generally chosen to change their patterns of behavior to stop the spread of the virus. So there are two input factors that both would explain why you hit a peak after 60 days. The one is social distancing, whatever the lockdown rules and regulations were, people just not going to restaurants, people not going to theaters and sports stadiums and the like. And on the other side, the natural immunity factor. And I think we're still trying to figure out what kind of weighting to apportion to either of those. One of the things that stands out about South Africa is that we have, I think, had some of the poorest social distancing in the world for a while. I mean, I think we did pretty well in early March and in parts of April, but because the state took so much of the resources into its own hands to impose this thing, there was like a lot of you were a very poor country, a lot of people need to get around, there's a lot of just taking shortcuts and going around corners and then feeling very lackadaisical about it. You go to inner cities, you go to townships in rural areas,
and people say that South Africa isn't a world leader.
Yeah, so I think that might partly explain why we might only have one peak. You know, other countries where people have managed to social distance properly will hit a peak, and then at some point they'll unwind those social distancing measures naturally or by law, and then there'll be another peak, and that second spike might not be as important because if it doesn't affect old people, and then you might even have a third and a fourth. You know, for example, you might have people just – it becomes normal to go to restaurants and kind of back to offices, but they still stay away from rock concerts and stadiums, so you get a second peak. And then when you have rock concerts and stadiums, again, you might find a third peak. But as I say, those might not be reflected in the death data. In South Africa, it does look like we're just shooting for one. And then the question of when that comes is determined by how – much this virus is being stopped by natural immunity. And in South Africa, so if a lot of the work is being done by natural immunity here and across the world, then I think we could hit the peak even sooner than France says. But if natural immunity isn't as strong as has been supposed by some of the researchers at Oxford and so on, then I think we could be looking at late August, September, still climbing this very slow mountain to a very grisly top.
Yeah, but I think because of the fact that, you know, younger people with infections isn't really a problem, when we speak of a peak, we should mean a peak in deaths.
Yeah.
Because now you've got this America phenomena of the second surge. I said it's not a second. People accustomed to the idea that the virus is terribly dangerous, kills large numbers of people, when they hear and a second wave, they think, oh, we're going through the whole ghastly saga again. markets rattle, they give up the gains they've made, politicians start locking down restaurants, all unnecessary. So the question needs to, we need to refine our question a bit, and not second waves, but will there be second waves of deaths that will rival what countries saw initially after they'd reached their 100th case?
And yeah, that seems highly unlikely. Eh? Yeah, very, very unlikely.
I think that's highly unlikely.
And of course, there's also the fact that every day we learn more things about this, how to treat it, and it's also possible, I wonder if the way medical professionals are treating these diseases is also resulting in a lower mortality rate. I wouldn't be surprised if that's a contributing factor. For example, I've heard that, making more use of oxygen and less ventilators seems to have some positive results on people, and treating symptoms more widely. So, for example, treating kidney diseases and stuff like that is also assisting to bring the
death rate. Yeah, the corollary to that is if you look at all-cause death data from Europe, from America, from various parts of the world, I think it's very grisly business. And COVID deaths have their share of all cause excess deaths has been relatively high. Their share of all cause deaths, of course, has been very, very small. Nicholas and I discussed the first time we talked about coronas back in February or whenever it was. We said you must remember the case of
Fukushima.
I always get that wrong, where there's a nuclear meltdown in Japan, and in response, the Japanese turned off all their nuclear reactors around the country. And 5 years later, an actuarial study found
a whole bunch of old people had been killed by the cold, basically.
Yes, more people died as a result of that overreaction than the initial tragedy. Far more people. And this is the thing that I keep looking out for. In some places, the all-cause excess deaths is already majority not COVID. And it's hard to explain what it is, stress-related, suicide, people not getting their cancer treatments, and so on. But that is only going to get worse. In particular, the economic-related problems are only going to get worse. What they found in the Japanese case is the sort of, the terrible disasters. There were some extra suicides and stuff like that in the first few months, but the real knock that you saw was a year later. I think we're going to see a much larger peak in deaths after COVID as an aftershock of the lockdowns than we saw during COVID as a result of the virus. And someone will hold me to that judgment, but it is a prediction.
No, I think that's definitely right. And I think we'll really only fully understand COVID a couple of years out from it, what it did and what the reactions did. All right. So I think we're going to close for today. Any final thoughts, Franz?
None at all. Thanks, Nick. Thanks, Gabriel. This was great.
No problem. And thank you to all of our friends. Thank you for those of you who are giving us that financial support that helps us to keep giving this alternative voice, to do the research and policy analysis we do, to fight for rights to property, life, liberty, all those good things. We really appreciate your support. And without it, we wouldn't be able to be the dynamic organization that we are. So if you'd like to become a friend of the Institute, please go to our website, click the Join Us button, give us your details, and we'll sign you up to become a friend of the Institute, give you a call. And thank you very much for joining us. Have a wonderful weekend, and we will catch you on the Monday edition of the Daily Fringe Show.